Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A content warning accompanies this podcast. Discussions include sexual violence, abuse, amongst others. And if you feel affected by any of these subjects, then please be aware. Welcome to Podcart's Life is Like a Box of Records podcast. My name is Helena Rafai. Occasionally, we bring in special guests to talk about the songs that have soundtracked their lives so far. For rights reasons, music might be shorter than the original song. Podcart's Life is Like a Box of Records is recorded, produced and edited by me, Helena Rafai. Original music is by Susan Baer, aka Good Dog. This week's guest is Miles Bonner. Miles is an award-winning journalist. He's recognised for his work with BBC Scotland, Panorama and BBC Disclosure. His investigative work and broadcasting has led to widespread coverage, acclaim, and more notably, the criminal conviction of Adnan Ahmed, who was a subject of Seduction Boot Camp, where Miles spent time undercover with so-called pickup coaches. He has most recently presented and produced the Unlocked podcast, which unearths stories from lockdown life. Miles, welcome to Podcart and welcome to Life is Like a Box of Records podcast. It's a real pleasure to have you. How are you?
I'm fine. Yeah, things are all kind of, everything's been turned upside down at the moment, but I'm doing all right. Yeah. How are you?
Brilliant. Yeah, not bad. It's introduced a lot of new ways of working and lots of DIY tech skills, and I've certainly increased my knowledge, I have to say. So I'm not sure if that's been the same for you. Have you had to kind of look at things in a different way of approach and journalism?
Yeah, I support that. Things have moved almost completely remote. I must admit, I still go into the BBC when it's, you know, essential to go in, but you know, it's the building's very quiet and they're doing things. It's everything's kind of in place. It's very safe in there. But most of the time I'm just working from home, and so far everything from a technology point of view has been working, which I'm completely shocked by.
Yeah.
So it's been fine.
So I guess what I want to start off is, for people that don't know who you are, if you can introduce yourself.
Yeah, well, I suppose I am a kind of journalist stroke producer at the BBC. I started working in radio in early 2014 and moved into kind of news and journalism shortly after that. And now I've got the pleasure of making kind of documentaries for the BBC and also making podcasts. And I kind of find myself in between working on kind of digital platforms and kind of normal news. So it's a good position to be in, and I'm very thankful for it. And I've had the opportunity to go undercover on a seduction boot camp for pickup artists, which was eye-opening. And since then I've had other opportunities come off the back of it. You know, it was a real big step for me getting to work with Panorama on that, and things so far have been, you know, been very good. So yeah, that's a bit about me.
Yeah, and I want to talk about Seduction Game kind of later on, and A Game and so on, which was profoundly shocking, but you did a phenomenal thing in exposing it. For the premise of people that don't know about the podcast, we get people to pick tracks that have soundtracked their life so far. You've picked, there's some really euphoric songs in here, which is amazing as well. So I kind of want to just kick off your intro song is without a doubt one of the probably most uplifting, and it's ABBA, Knowing Me, Knowing You. So why did you pick this?
Yeah, well, for me, this song, it really reminds me of my grandparents, you know. So they're penned up in their house in Crossgates and Fife at the moment, and, you know, this time's really hitting them hard. And this is like one of my earliest memories of, you know, music in my life, getting ready to go to Disney with my grandparents when I was five. And this was playing in the background. They had ABBA Gold on VHS, and I just remember kind of getting dressed at 5 a.m, ready for I think it was my first flight, and just so excited. And this song, it catapults me back there every time I hear it. They're going through a real, you know, difficult time, just having to stay in constantly because, you know, because of their age, you know, they're very healthy and they go out a lot and they're not used to being kind of penned up like this. So yeah, that's my earliest song that I can think of.
And what are some of the other musical memories you have as a child at that age?
Yeah, well, some of them probably are quite... like Doctor Hook. There's a lot of Doctor Hook. I'm trying to think of others at the top of my head. I just like that. That reminds me a lot of being in like my granddad's car, you know. I'm thinking, the top of my head, other tracks. There's tons of ABBA. I can't believe how much ABBA there was, and a lot of Roy Orbison as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'd say that's the kind of earliest part.
So did you grow up in Fife?
No. So I had a kind of my upbringing is a bit all over the place. So I was born in Inverness. Yeah, I grew up in Tain until I was about 7, which is like about an hour north of Inverness. And then I moved to Indonesia at that age and lived there for a year and a half because of my dad's job at the time. And then I moved back to Tain, and then I moved to Abu Dhabi for a year and a half in the United Arab Emirates. And then I moved to Inverness, and that's where I kind of class. That's my home. That's where all my closest friends are from. And then I moved to Brazil for 2.5 years, lived in Rio de Janeiro because of my dad's work, and came back to Scotland to go to university in Stirling. But Inverness has always been my home. My whole family are from Fife. I'm the only one that was born at Rigmore Hospital in Inverness, but that is definitely my home. But yeah, it's very hard to pin my accent sometimes because it's just a bit all over the place.
What was it like for you going between all of those different countries? Did you feel resentful that you were having to kind of keep moving around, or were you just it was about, you know, being with your family and so on?
Yeah, I think that the early moves, you know, Indonesia and Abu Dhabi, I was young enough then that it wasn't really much of an upheaval to my life to be moving like that. And I would say I kind of just went with it and you know, it was great. Moving to Brazil was a trickier time because I think I was just, you know, shortly after I was 14. And that's when you really have your kind of, you know, your closest friends and, you know, your kind of friends for life. Well, that's how I find it anyway. So that was really tricky, you know, moving away at that time and basically just keeping in touch with people over MSN. You know, I'm amazingly, I've managed to keep those friendships even being away for that amount of time. So, for example, my best friend, you know, two best friends from Inverness, I live with one of them now in Glasgow, still live together. And my other, you know, other pal lives in, he's in Annie's Land, so he's really close as well. So after having that much kind of upheaval at that age, it hasn't really caused me an issue. If anything, it helped, you know, if you can adjust to those kind of big moves, then I suppose it helps you in some way.
moving on to your next pick, introduce that for us and please explain why you picked this.
Yeah, so this track is Pixies, Where Is My Mind? You know, in terms of films that have had a massive impact on me, this was the final track, you know, the last tune at the end of Fight Club, which just like blew my mind. I just loved that film. And that film kind of led me down, you know, a rabbit hole in terms of the types of TV shows and films that I love, you know, David Fincher films and TV shows like, you know, House of Cards and Seven and Mindhunter. I just love them. And it also led me to kind of find a long interview with Chuck Palahniuk, who had this amazing interview on the Joe Rogan podcast about how his creative process. And it was almost like when I heard that, I was working in the media at the time, but that interview just blew my mind. And the way he talks about creativity and how he knows that he is getting to a good point in his writing and the things that he creates when people react to it negatively or have a negative reaction to it. Like, he was kicked out of numerous writing rooms because the things he was writing were shocking people. Just thought that's an amazing way of thinking, you know, that when you get a negative reaction or a lot of feedback which isn't always positive, then maybe you're actually pushing the boundaries of what you're doing and creating something new. So that song kind of has intertwined into like loving that movie and the types of programs that I like, and even getting to hear that interview and being tied to Chuck Palahniuk, who actually wrote the book Fight Club. Song's really important to me.
I want to kind of go back a bit back to your teenage years, and I guess what I want to know is your exposure to the media at that age and music and film and so on. Were there any years during that time that you kind of really instilled a love for the media and creativity?
Yeah, a big part of my teenage years was I was really into kind of emo and screamo and like kind of I loved Taking Back Sunday and Senses Fail and Slipknot, you know, and I think that was a really creative time in music. I don't know, maybe it's because I'm a bit older and I don't see it as much, but I just remember there was just something unbelievable, like so cool about buying albums and music videos coming out then. It was so creative, like you'd go through the entire booklet of this CD that had been imported into, you know, an HMV in Inverness, and it just, everything, the artwork and the lyrics and just everything about listening and consuming music back then, I loved it. And I suppose that was kind of that new metal emo phase where I was buying albums so much. And so yeah, I think that was kind of, I don't know if that's the direct source of really being interested in the media and creative industries, but that was definitely the time where, you know, I started, you know, I was in a band at that age called Curio. You know, we got to support Enter Shikari, and
wow,
it was all these things. You know, we supported Enter Shikari in this, it was called Downtown USA. It was like a kind of rundown, like youth hall in Inverness. And we supported them in there, and there must have been, I don't know, 300 people. It was like us, Flood of Red and Enter Shikari in this kind of almost barn-like building. And it was like feeling like you're really at the beginning of something, because, you know, they went on to be huge, and we were all just obsessed with those types of records at the time. So I think that has maybe a lot to do with it, you know, getting into music and really starting to get creative.
Mm-hmm. And some of the countries that you've mentioned that you moved to, Indonesia and Brazil and also Abu Dhabi and so on, were you exposed to any musical culture differences and anything that stood out for you and made you kind of think about things a bit differently?
I think not so much in Abu Dhabi and Indonesia, but I was off the age when I lived in Brazil that I was consuming Brazilian rock music. So there was a band called Detonautas, and then there was Charlie Brown Jr. They were the two ones that I can kind of remember. I think Peachy was the other one. And they were kind of like new metal rock rap artists in Brazil. Mm-hmm. I remember buying their albums, and they were all in Portuguese. but I think I was still taking a lot of music from back home. I know a family friend's daughter, her boyfriend had come over to Brazil for a few days. They were living over there as well. And he had given me Deftones Adrenaline.
Oh, wow.
And that was just like, just blew my mind. I just absolutely loved it. And I became obsessed with Deftones after that. And I also... you know, it's a bit of a strange mix, but I also got The Remote Part by Idlewild back then.
Yeah.
And similarly, I just absolutely loved those records. And in neither the end of my time in Brazil, I did come back to Inverness for a short period of time to see friends and then go back. And I came back with Funeral for a Friend's first album, which I can't remember what it was called, but it had like two people back to back with like a kind of, it was like quite an arty front cover, and I just listened to that album on repeat. So every little snippet that I would get from what people were listening to back home, I would just become obsessed with.
When you went to Stirling University, how did things kind of alter for you, and did they change significantly to previous years? Did you alter as a person, or was it just basically a kind of continuation? You were on the path that you knew where you wanted to go.
Actually, it was quite a big moment. Actually, I'd tried to get into art school. I tried to get into Glasgow School of Art, and I had an interview stage, and then there's a kind of final stage where I think you submit a portfolio, and I didn't get in, and I was gutted about it because that's all I wanted to do. And I remember my dad took me to Stirling University because I'd always been into history. Like my granddad's a massive, he just consumes history books like they're, just consumes them like they're novels. So mm-hmm. I went there. It was something that I hadn't really thought about doing, and went to Stirling Uni, and I just really just loved studying there. I really got into history, and I think that's when I started to realise that I wanted to be a journalist, because that kind of finding primary and secondary sources to build an argument and let the kind of the reader decide what they think happened is such a big part of history. And you know, when you actually apply it to what journalism's like, it fits quite well. So I started to realize then that I'd want to do journalism after that, and that strangely kind of led to after I finished University of Stirling, I knew I wanted to do journalism, and I got into the University of Chester to do a master's in journalism. So I got ready to move to the northwest of England, moved, and the course got cancelled. And
oh, no.
Yeah, so I moved to Manchester. I tried to get into Salford University to do their journalism course, and I didn't get in. I failed the entrance exam, and I was stuck in Manchester with kind of no reason to be there.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up getting into recruitment, and that was my career. I was a recruitment consultant.
How was that?
I met great people, but it was not the job for me. I'm lucky that I have a job, which I love doing, and I look forward to going into work, but I did... I suppose after being there for 3 years, whatever, I did start to feel like I was penned in, kind of pigeonholed, and I didn't know what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And I only left that job when I applied for work experience at BBC Radio Scotland to work on the phone-ins, which was, I think it was called Morning Call back then. And I applied to do phone-in shifts. And I got a week work experience, and I decided, I wasn't able to, I was still working at the time, so I took a week's holiday from my recruitment job, because at this point I'd managed to get a move from Manchester's recruitment office to Glasgow's recruitment office, so I was able mm-hmm. to work at Radio Scotland. I did the week, I got offered 3 weeks off the back of it, and I quit my job.
Wow.
And that's kind of, I've stayed working at the BBC since, but yeah, that was quite a big change in my life at the time.
Before I move on to the next stage of your career, I want to talk about your next song, which is Naked and Famous. And this is such a brilliant, almost kind of summer song, but you might have different memories. So why did you pick this?
It's kind of happy and sad, the reasons for this track. My time at Stirling University, I met like friends for life. And one of my closest friends, Bobby Hetherington, we all called him Momo. I met him at university, and we were friends for like, you know, the 4 years that we were there. And he tragically was killed in Afghanistan in 2013. He went and joined the army, and he was killed. And so that was on the 30th of April in 2013. And so that was, you know, 7 years on Thursday just passed. Mm-hmm. And this song, he was absolutely obsessed with it. And I liked the song, but, you know, he absolutely loved it. And now when I hear it, it's just like, it's quite a happy feeling when I hear it. When we were at university together, and you know, he was just like larger than life guy, so happy, and just, you know, everyone loved him. And then when I hear that song now, it does make me feel, you know, it's like happy and sad mixed, and I love it now. You know, I listen to it, you know, when I'm stressed or when I'm on a flight or whatever. And it's an important one.
What impact did his death have on yourself and the group of friends that were around you?
Yeah, it was really difficult, you know. We just really couldn't believe it. You know, he always talked about going away and wanting to join the forces, and you know, I don't think anyone was really keen for him to do that, but that is what he wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And it was very early on, you know, a lot of it becomes quite hazy. I don't know if your mind just switches off parts of it and you can't remember little details, but I do remember it was quite early into him going out there, and it was just a massive, massive shock. You know, I can only really remember slight details of the day of being told. I got phoned by one of my friends from university to let me know, and I don't know. I think your brain just kind of switches off aspects of it. But you know, at the time, another one of my close friends, Paul Tracy, who went to university with Momo and myself, he lived quite near to me. So we went to like Sweeney's on the Park, you know, in Glasgow, and just had pints and talked about, you know, old times and stuff like that. So we managed to process it all, because, you know, we were still in contact. You know, everyone that was friends at, you know, with Momo were able to talk and really kind of deal with it. deal with it's maybe not the right word, but you know what I mean, we were maybe able to get through it. But yeah, it was an absolute shocker, and it still is. But yeah, this song is kind of, it's all the kind of good things, you know, all the good things that he brought that is kind of rolled up into that one tune.
Yeah. Going back to your career and as it's progressed, you've obviously said that you've moved back to Glasgow. You've got 3 weeks more on the back of the 1 week of experience that you did. How did things then progress for you into becoming more of your own person as a journalist?
Yeah, well, I think I really learned loads from working in phone-ins. I think from joining the BBC at that time, there was just so much going on politically in Scotland and in the UK. So, you know, from joining at the start of, you know, a few months into 2014, if you just think about all the events that had happened, from that moment on, it was a real kind of, it really tested your, I suppose, your work ethic and trying to find, you know, kind of what stories really matter to people in Scotland. And I think those years with, you know, referendums and general elections and all those other things and having to work in phone-ins and in news and then eventually moving to work in social media for the social, I managed to learn quite a lot of different things from different parts of the BBC. So I got to kind of learn the radio side of things and the news side of things from the newsroom and then how digital stories could be told. So I think being able to kind of move around and try different jobs really helped me.
I do want to talk a bit about the seduction game and so on. But before that, I want to talk about your next song, which is John Hopkins, who has just, his rise, it's meteoric over the last couple of years. And he's produced some of the best music, you know, in my generation, I would say. Why did you pick this song in particular?
Yeah, well, this song, it actually is the kind of soundtrack to those big changes in life. This is actually when I kind of moved from recruitment to the BBC and then moving into a flat. You know, I moved into a flat, which I'm still in now. At the time, there were 7 of us in it. And everyone in that flat had all been, it was a very exciting time for all of us. You know, I live with professional cyclists, Danny McCaskill, Duncan Shaw, Ali Clarkson. And at the time, I lived with a skate park designer, John Bailey, and a video editor at Cut Media that made Danny McCaskill's films, Paul. And, you know, through that period, we also had other folks staying with us. You know, we had a friend from Manchester called Ricky, and we basically just had this flat just crammed full of people who were all kind of doing exciting things at the time. And that tune came out, I remember I heard it driving on Zane Lowe's Radio 1 show, mm-hmm. I think it was back then, and it just became like the song of summer, you know, having kind of barbecues and going on the balcony all the time and just having a great time. All happening when I was making big changes with my kind of line of work and things as well. So yeah, it really sticks with me, that tune, and I listen to it, you know, still now to this day. I'll put it on if I'm in the gym or going for a walk or whatever. It still gets played.
You've done incredibly well. You're an award winner now, based on some of the work that you've done. And the Seduction Game and your work with Panorama, and exposing people like, as he was called, A-Game, Adnan Ahmed. When did you first become aware of this, and why did you decide to go ahead and expose what was happening?
I first became aware of it when there was a phone call into Radio Scotland. So someone had phoned in to the Kay Adams programme it was called then. Someone had phoned in and said that there was a person that they go to college with who has this YouTube channel which they were concerned about. So I got past this call from my girlfriend, who actually works in radio. She, you know, said this is something that you should maybe have a listen to. And when I'd found this YouTube channel, I realised that, you know, there was a lot of stuff on there that needed looked into, and that would have been in October 2018. And mm-hmm. from that point on, I'd been in communication with Adnan Ahmed, ADA Game, trying to get an interview with him to ask him why he had this dating and lifestyle coaching website, as it was known. And there were things on there that I wanted to ask him about, you know, apparent recordings which seemed to be, you know, of an intimate nature, that I wanted to find out why they were posted, and just really put questions to him. I never got that interview, but I managed to get a response from YouTube, who had kind of realised that these videos were breaking their community guidelines because of the sexual nature of them, and they started deleting videos. And then that's when I knew there was a story there. Mm-hmm. And that we were going to run a video about this person and what we'd found. That video was published on, I think it was January 9th, 2019, and he was arrested 2 days later from what was in there. It was from what was in that video had sparked a reaction online. I think a lot of people were angered by it. Some people had recognised this behaviour in the person, and others had decided to come forward to the police and report what had happened to them. And then there was an arrest and then a court case, and things just kind of, it just rolled and became a much bigger story, thanks to, you know, those people that were coming forward and speaking about what happened to them.
I remember the initial video that went up, and I'd then gone on to YouTube. I think some of the videos were still up, and couldn't believe what I was seeing. It did make me, you know, me and others physically sick, I think, was happening. And when you're within this and you're investigating this, and I know that when you were speaking to various, well, I hate even calling them pickup artists, but when they're these people that are committing these things on the streets and blatantly denying, and you can see that you're visibly becoming a bit more angered by it and challenging them. But when you're investigating this and you're hearing the stories from those affected and the victims, how do you keep yourself in check, both mentally and, I guess, you know, just to keep within a journalist frame of mind without it, I suppose, affecting you too much?
Yeah, that's a really good question, to be honest. I think you constantly need to check in with, you know, others. I think what really helped during the kind of bigger investigation for Disclosure and Panorama was having like really great people around you that you could bounce ideas off them and kind of repeat back things that you'd seen, because you're right, you become desensitized at some points because you've been having to consume so much of this stuff that sometimes you're like, you know, is that as wrong as I think it is? Mm-hmm. Is that a story? Is that, you know, but you've obviously been consuming so much of this stuff that it brings the bar higher as to what you think's wrongdoing. And you need to constantly keep checking in to make sure, you know, I'm on the right road here. That is a big part of it. And I think that helped me a lot, being able to just kind of run things that I'd found by people to say, you know, are you finding this as troubling as I am, or is there something here that I'm missing? And then in terms of kind of not letting it impact you mentally, like luckily I've not had any kind of troubles with that yet, where it's made me feel it's really impacted me mentally, and I've felt like I can't watch or consume any more of this stuff. I think at that point when you're working on it, I would say you're so busy that you just keep going until you have a film or you have a story, and that kind of stops you from thinking about things too much. And it's only after you deliver it that you can start to go, right, well, you know, this was a really tricky situation, or that was really disturbing, and all those things that you've experienced, you can, you know, have a think about retrospectively. But at the time, you're just so busy, I don't think it has enough time to impact you mentally. But there is a lot of checking in to say, you know, I've found this, and, you know, am I on the right path here? Because you can become really desensitized. You know how wrong it is, but you don't know, you know, even things like what should you include in a film. And I think you maybe there's things that you forget that, you know, an audience watching at 8:30 on BBC One, they would find that really offensive, but you've been watching so much of it that you maybe think, oh no, that should go in the film because it's really important that it's in there. But you're obviously speaking from a point of view where you've seen all those other videos and you have a bit of context for it, but you've got to really be careful when you're making that film for an audience who are coming at it cold, that you don't put in something there that is just too far. It's gone too far. And depressingly, we had to omit, and rightfully so, a lot of stuff that was, too offensive, or it wouldn't make a film at that time of night. So that just shows you the kind of the depths that some of these men will go, that you know, you can't even show it on an investigative program because of how offensive it is.
Did you were you ever worried at any stage about your own personal safety?
During being undercover, I think it's actually similar feeling to before. It's kind of like you're just so caught up in it that you forget. Like, I know on the mornings before going in to do it, you would feel really sick and nervous about it, you know, having hardly slept and just worrying about it. But once you're actually in the thick of it, and, you know, the day starts just going on as normal, and no one suspects you to be anyone else, then you forget and you just kind of get on with it. So it all just kind of, it happens so quickly. There were long days. There were very long days, but, you know, before you know it, the weekend's over and you're out of there. So, yeah, I didn't have too many worries about my safety. And also, I must admit as well that this is, this was dealing with so-called seduction coaches. You know, there's people that go undercover with, you know, drug dealers and gangs and things like that. You know, just unbelievably brave, undercover jobs that journalists have done. So I suppose, I always knew if things had gone wrong and they'd realised I was someone else, then I would probably got out okay. It would have just been very awkward. And there's always, you know, being a BBC operation, there's so many checks and so much planning and risk assessment that goes into this, that every scenario has been thought through to make it as safe as possible. So you really do feel like you've got options if something was to go wrong.
We are going to move on to your next pick, which is Grimes. And tell us about this and why it's so significant for you.
Yeah, well, this is quite a similar time to open eye signal. I met my current girlfriend at this time, and also it was a song that, you know, I'd been sent the tune by, I think it was my sister at the time, and I just absolutely loved it. You know, I just thought it was so, it's really relaxing. It's like a really relaxing tune. Other people get that impression from it, but I listen to this a lot to kind of chill me out, and I have like this playlist that almost all the tracks in it don't have any vocals. It's like the sort of music I put on when I'm writing or I'm trying to relax, but this song's always on there. I think it's because her voice just kind of intertwines with the music. It doesn't sound, you know when you're trying to like concentrate and write. Mm-hmm. Someone's lyrics or really strong vocals can kind of stop you from concentrating, but her voice just seems to run almost like an instrument through it. So this song, you know, one, it was kind of a really great tip from my sister. It underpins like a big moment in my life. You know, it was same kind of time as these career changes and meeting my girlfriend and having that great summer, and also it's just a song that I kind of turn to a lot of the time when I'm trying to unwind or concentrate.
Speaking of more kind of instrumental music and Mogwai, one of our finest exports. So I mean, they're a huge band for so many people, and you and I share a lot of the same kind of circles. Yeah. So why did you pick Tracy out of the you know, mammoth back catalogue that the band have?
So there's a few reasons I just love this song, and it's just so important. As I had the chance to work with Paul Savage in 2015. I was in a band at the time, and we got to record at Chem 19, Chemical Underground's studios, and we met Paul. He, you know, produced a few of the songs we went in to record. You know, I'm no longer in a band, but back then I was, and we got to meet him, and he's just such a, you know, down to earth cool guy. And I just remember Young Team was on the wall in Chemical Underground, and I was just like, I think that I would always listen to Come On Die Young. That was this album that I would always go to, and I think when we went to that studio and seen the place where it was recorded, and just like hear a little bit more about how that track was made from Paul, I just thought, you know, I'm going to go back to that album and you know, listen to it again. And then since then, I honestly think I've got some sort of obsessive, compulsive. it's just I have to listen to this song, like my friends, family, you know, my girlfriend, I must listen to this song every single day. It's not, wow. not even a joke. I put it on all the time and I just love it. You know, I love the call to the manager at the end and, you know, all those little bits of kind of just little snippets that they've kind of put over the instrumental track. And it's just so, it's like a really peaceful song. I love it. I listen to it every single day. Having kind of met and knowing the person that produced it, as well as just loving Mogwai, I just love this song. And so much so, in my last documentary, A Question of Consent, which I made with Disclosure, we managed to get that song in the film. You know, I spent a lot of time working on the soundtrack for that film. You know, I really think music is extremely important when telling kind of stories, especially in like a film format. And living with Danny McCaskill, you know, he spends so much time looking at music before he makes his videos. And it's kind of rubbed off on me, you know, really think about what songs fit with different emotions and what songs fit with different parts of a story you're trying to tell. And I just was delighted to be able to get Mogwai Tracy into that film as the very end tune, when you're kind of summing up in a piece to camera about what you found throughout the whole investigation. And I just love it. I love it.
Speaking of A Question of Consent, I mean, comparatively with obviously The Seduction Game and the tie-in, I guess, of women and how much they're abused and victimised, and just the focus on treating them in a way that is just abhorrent. But there's obviously a tie-in, but with A Question of Consent, you were looking into the rise of rough sex, as they call it. Yeah. What was the experience like making that? And were there times that you were really shocked with some of the stuff that you were being exposed to?
Yeah, I think the most shocked I was making this film, you know, this was a very different film from The Seduction Game, because there was less of a, I suppose, like with The Seduction Game, there's a focus, you know who the people are that you're looking into, and there's an end goal as to what you want to get and then put to them to get, have them respond. With this, it was a lot more kind of nuanced, and we were just trying to see, I suppose, look at society and all the different things that maybe feed into this normalization of rough sex, or, you know, so-called rough sex that is not, you know, not consented to. And there was, you know, because of that, we were very much just kind of, you know, learning each day from our interviews about what the film was going to be, and just learning as we went. You know, it took shape over the kind of months that we worked on it. You know, it was, you know, it wasn't even that long. I think it was two and a half months or something. And there weren't as many, depressingly, there wasn't as many shocking moments. There was a lot of things that I thought beforehand was the case. You know, I suppose the influence of free online porn and how it could be misinterpreted or misunderstood by, you know, younger viewers. I thought that would be the case, and it was something that fed into this film from an early part. You know, the early research we'd done into the film, we did think that had a big tie into this, so that wasn't a surprise. But going through the case of Chloe Mizak was quite shocking. You know, I think maybe to most, very shocking. But seeing how someone who has been killed, how their lives are kind of just put completely out in the open in a courtroom, and being unable to defend yourself. And in the case of Chloe Mizak, it was very much clear from what we'd read and what we'd presented in the film that there was a lot of time spent on, essentially implicating some of her actions by saying, you know, she was going out a lot, she was drinking a lot, she was doing this, that, and the other, in a court case which was about unconsensual choking, which resulted in someone losing their life. And I think just seeing that in black and white was quite it made you stop and think. So there wasn't as many moments where you're like, you know, this is extremely shocking content we're seeing, like, you know, what we were finding on YouTube and elsewhere for the seduction game. But going through that story with Chloe Mysick's parents was the most difficult thing to do. And thankfully, they felt, you know, comfortable enough to speak to us. And, you know, it was extremely brave of them to do so. But it was troubling hearing them talk through what it was like to find out that news. You know, it's just completely broken them. And it was important that we told that story, but it was very difficult to hear.
Do you, I mean, obviously that case also echoed, it was echoed recently by the British backpacker, Grace Mullane, it was a kind of similar thing that had happened. And it's just, I don't think it ever becomes less shocking when you hear about these things. And these women are not able, or these people are not able to defend themselves, as you say. Do you feel almost a kind of sense of duty that to provide something like that for them, that you're kind of continuing their legacy almost, and providing something for their families that shows that they shouldn't have died in the ways that they passed?
Yeah, I think it's really important that there is there's something that comes out of all of this that's, you know, in some way positive. And it's hard to tell now because it's not been that long since those films were out, but maybe it could change things. You know, telling those stories and having what happened to certain people, have all those facts laid out for the audience to kind of make a judgment on and make their own mind up, that might change things. In terms of legislation, in terms of the pickup artist film, we know that YouTube ended up deleting hundreds of videos and closing down channels that had been there for years. So I think it is, yeah, I think that is a motivator, is telling people's stories, but also that there might be something that comes off the back of it, which makes mm-hmm. the chance of this thing happening again a little bit less likely. Mm-hmm. So I would say that is, yeah, it is sharing those stories that maybe haven't been told or haven't been given as much attention as maybe they should have done, and the potential of a change.
Another sonically powerful band and your last pick already, these podcasts seems to go so quickly, The Twilight Sad, which is a band that connects so many of us now. Why is this song so special for you?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I was so looking forward to seeing them in the Barras again.
Yeah.
And I could not wait for it. You know, the last time I'd seen them in there, it was just so emotional. Yeah. Were you at that gig?
I was, and I sobbed like you. I was just standing there crying for the whole thing.
Oh, it was just amazing, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And I was so looking forward to it, and I just thought this would be a good song to kind of have last on the list, because it's quite representative of the time we're in just now. You know, we don't know when we'll be able to go to gigs again. We don't know when we're going to experience, you know, live events like that. You know, it's going to happen, surely, hopefully. But mm-hmm. we're in this kind of unknown at the moment, and this song just stands out. You know, seeing it at that gig, as well as listening, this is one of my songs that I listen to like constantly. And yeah, I think it's quite a good one for the time that we're in right now. Sad song, but it's also, I find it really uplifting, and there is just so much tied into it, you know, thinking about seeing them at the Barras, being excited about, you know, seeing them before the gig got cancelled recently. And I'm also a big Frightened Rabbit fan. And I think every time you go and see Twilight Sad, you know, especially if they cover a Frightened Rabbit tune, there's a real connection there. And yeah, I just find watching Twilight Sad and listening to their albums is a complete mix of emotions. And that's why I love, and that track particularly, I just love it.
Before we go, I want to talk about the last couple of things. So you're working on this podcast series, Unlocked. So tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, so that this podcast is aimed for, I suppose it's like the stories that haven't been getting, you know, rightfully so, that the news and government briefings have to focus on the daily updates with this pandemic and how we keep each other safe and all these other things. And that is, there's a reason why that is the top of the priority list for news. But I do think there's kind of a lot of aspects of life which would normally be a huge thing, like, you know, going to university or going to your first festival or just looking, you know, going to the pub with your friends at the weekend or having anxiety or struggling with depression. These things are normally huge issues, which would be at the forefront of the stories that we would tell and discuss. But things have just been put on the back burner and given less prominence on our priority list when it comes to reporting. This podcast will hopefully give a bit of breathing space to those issues and let particularly a younger audience talk about these things and give time to those worries and the impact of this pandemic on them. And we'll be wanting to cover stories every week which we feel haven't been told elsewhere. So the first episode went live yesterday morning, and it's probably why you get your hearing my voice breaking every now. It's been a stressful few days. But the first episode went live yesterday morning, and within that episode we speak to a sex worker who is currently breaking lockdown to make ends meet, as well as speaking to Leslie Strang from Belladrum Festival and Jonathan Dawson from SWG3 about the future of music and how festivals and gigs may change when they open up. And we're hoping this will be a great platform for younger adults in Scotland to start, you know, speaking out about the things that are really impacting them. So yeah, it's been a crazy first week, and we're hoping that people can get in touch with stories and we can give some time to them.
I want to end on a real positive, and the fact that you're a gold winner, you won an ARIA. That must have been unbelievable. Did you expect that you were going to win that, first of all? I mean, obviously a lot of people say no, but they secretly think, yeah, maybe I've got an edge in here. But also, how did it feel to win?
I'm speaking completely honestly. I had no clue I was going to win it. I had no idea. I've really felt as if Radio 4 were going to win it. I think I was up against the Anatomy of a Stabbing, as well as a Radio Manchester podcast, which was covering, I think it was the police on the beat in the city, yeah, which was another amazing podcast, you know, in comparison to the Radio 4 one. And so I did feel like, you know, it was a great to be nominated and a great trip to London. You know, I'd never been to an awards event. That's the first one, first and last award event I've been to. And I was just glad to be there. So when I got announced, I just couldn't believe it. And it's probably a good way of describing how I handled it, because I went up and I spoke for about 6 seconds. I just, it's like, thank you very much, you know, tried to get up the stage as quick as possible. And then I walked off the wrong bit as well. I walked like down the stairs back to my seat when I'm supposed to go through the back. Yeah, I didn't really know how to handle it. And I think that is evidence of not being surprised to have won it. But it felt amazing. And, you know, obviously people, you know, you don't do these things for awards, but it does feel good when you get them and you think, oh, you know, maybe, you know, I suppose it just gives the things that you've done a little bit of a, you know, just a nice little line under it to say, well, that was, you know, perhaps a good thing. So yeah, I was delighted, and I still am. You know, I still can't believe it.
Well, we've come to the end already. I really appreciate you speaking to me. It's fascinating, the work that you're doing, and it's important journalism as well. So, and I know how busy you are, so I am very grateful, and I wish you all the best going forward.
Thank you very much. It's been great to speak to you. So thanks for having me.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.